As the holidays creep closer, the days are getting busier, routines are being thrown off by parties, endless to-dos, and that's why I reached for Tempo this year. I really liked how on their website, they ask you your goals and let me pick the multiple that I have, right? I want meals to be protein-packed, 30 grams of protein, carb-conscious, fiber-rich, right? And they had tons of choices for me. These are real meals already cooked and ready in minutes and actually good for you, helping me stay balanced while enjoying the celebrations. So what is Tempo? It's going to deliver fresh, chef-crafted, dietitian-approved meals to your door. They rotate about 20 new recipes every single week. So Tempo will keep things exciting, but also help us stay consistent with healthy habits. Fun fact, Tempo is even the official partner of the 2025 CrossFit Games. So really kind of saying that these meals are built to support optimal nutrition and performance. And for a limited time, Tempo is offering Core AM listeners 60% off your first box. So go to tempomeals.com/coream. That's tempomeals.com/coream for 60% off your first box. tempomeals.com/coream. Rules and restrictions may apply. And with that, let's get back to the episode. Welcome to the Core AM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, and I'm joined by...
I am Dr. Noah Markowitz, a PGY3 internal medicine resident at Montefiore in the Bronx. Today's episode is part 2 of our 2-part series all about hepatorenal syndrome.
And if you haven't done already, go back and listen to the last episode on all things diagnosis.
Today's episode will be all things treatment.
And let's remind ourselves who our wonderful discussants are.
Hi, I'm Marina Serper. I am a hepatologist at the University of Pennsylvania.
Hi, I am Juan Carlos Feliz. I am a nephrologist at Ochsner Health in New Orleans.
My name is Nick Lazumder. I'm one of the transplant hepatologists here at University of Michigan.
And let's get into the 5 pearls we're going to be covering today. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, vasoconstrictors.
What are the 3 vasoconstrictors that are used to treat hepatorenal syndrome?
Pearl 2, albumin.
What's the role of albumin in treating hepatorenal syndrome?
Pearl 3, volume management.
Is it safe to give diuretics in somebody who's in hepatorenal syndrome?
Pearl 4, transplant.
How should we approach dialysis as well as transplant in a person with hepatorenal syndrome?
Pearl 5, palliative care.
What are the different options when it comes to palliative care in someone with HRS?
Okay, so the main goal for the treatment of HRS, big picture-wise, is to raise the mean arterial pressure, or the MAP. And this is done with vasoconstrictors.
Wait, Noah, I'm kind of confused. We spent so much time in the last episode talking about the whole problem with hepatorenal syndrome and too much renal vasoconstriction, and now you're telling me the treatment is to actually give vasoconstrictors? Something's not adding up here.
A question that I often get is, how is on earth is a vasoconstrictor fixing a vasoconstrictive pathogenesis? Well, because once you restore systemic arterial blood pressure, number one, that is going to override the renal perfusion pressure. And number two, you're resetting what is actually causing the local vasoconstriction in the kidneys in the first place. That's why the renal perfusion actually improves. And there are experimental and translational data showing that that's the case.
Okay. So giving vasoconstrictors gets the baroreceptors, gets the kidneys to once again sense that good pressure and volume. And the thought is that this reverses the cascade that actually led up to that vasoconstriction in the first place.
That's exactly right, Treya. And we actually have some evidence to help us with what we should aim for in terms of how much to raise that MAP. A 2023 study that Dr. Velez actually took part in used 77 HRS patients and divided them into 3 groups based on how much the MAP was raised with vasoconstrictors. The lowest group was 5 to 10, the middle group was 10 to 14, and the highest group was greater than 15. And what was found is that in the group with greater than 15 raise in MAP, they actually did the best.
just to say it out loud, because I know we spent so much time in the last episode really differentiating between hepatorenal versus ATN and prurenal. Just to say it out loud, vasoconstriction is really the treatment when it comes to hepatorenal syndrome. The idea is to restore that MAP, reset hemodynamics. But say you're dealing with prurenal AKI, that treatment is really volume expansion with albumin, for example. No need for vasoconstrictors. Similarly, ATN, treatment supportive care. No role for vasoconstrictors.
With that understanding, let's talk through the three treatment options we have to raise that MAP and try and reverse HRS.
We're going to start with most potent, and then we're going to finish up with the tried and true but least potent. So terlipressin, number one, is the most potent agent, but the one that we've in the United States have the least experience with. So terlipressin is a vasopressin agonist. It acts on the V1 receptors. It causes splanchnic vasoconstriction. It was approved in the United States in 2022, but has been used in Europe for many, many years. So the pivotal data in the United States for terlipressin comes from the confirmed trial. So in the confirmed trial, among patients with HRS-AKI, 32% of patients who received terlipressin plus albumin had HRS reversal versus 17% with albumin alone. And they were less likely to require renal replacement therapy at 30 days or have recurrence of HRS-AKI, but they had a lot more respiratory events, and there never been demonstration that 90-day outcomes have improved.
So the confirmed trial not only showed that terlipressin raises the MAP, but put terlipressin on the MAP as one of our best agents for HRS.
I see what you did there with the MAP pun. Yeah, putting terlipressin on the MAP. Nice, nice.
Thank you, thank you. With this trial, we saw less need for dialysis and reversal of HRS in 32% of patients who got terlipressin plus albumin versus only 17% of patients with albumin alone.
The main side effects of terlipressin are diarrhea, volume overload, cardiovascular ischemia. Less common side effect is limb ischemia, which I have seen clinically. It's a splanchnic vasoconstrictor, so it shunts blood from the splanchnic vasculature to the central circulation, so increases your preload. And then it also increases your SVR, systemic vascular resistance, so increases your afterload. And then albumin adds to that too, because it increases your plasma oncotic pressure. So patients who are already volume overloaded or almost volume overloaded or have coronary ischemia, they're at significant potential risk of compromise and side effects of terlipressin. So I think understanding the physiology is really helpful.
So what type of ischemia is actually enough for someone to think about holding off on terlipressin? One of our peer reviewers, Dr. Belcher, told us his practice is anyone with active coronary artery disease or untreated ischemia should avoid terlipressin. But if they have CAD that was stented in the past and they're doing okay, it's probably fine to give terlipressin. But what's really important to keep in mind is these patients have such a high, very short-term mortality that you might just take the risk anyway.
And then another pearl is creatinine greater than 5, MELD score greater than or equal to 35, so really high MELD scores, or grade 3 ACLF, that's essentially multiple organ failures. You don't really get a lot of bang for your buck with terlipressin. It's kind of too late in that scenario, so we don't usually start that. That's associated with higher mortality.
Okay, so no terlipressin if the kidney disease is really bad, the creatinine's over 5, or with the liver failure, if it's grade 3 acute on chronic liver failure, aka this person just has a really high MELD, terlipressin's a no-go.
Okay, thanks for summarizing terlipressin for us. Next up in terms of potency is norepinephrine.
So norepinephrine, tried and true vasopressor, right? We use in the ICU all the time, very potent, has good evidence, decent evidence, I would say, in HRS. So the mechanism, it is alpha-1 agonist causing vasoconstriction, beta-1 agonist causing increased cardiac output.
So norepi is an infusion, typically requires an ICU transfer, which can be difficult depending on how comfortable nurses on the floors are. And so it kind of makes me think like the decision between terlipressin versus norepi for this patient really comes down to where our patient physically is.
That actually makes me wonder if we have any data that compare terlipressin versus norepinephrine since they're used in different areas.
Data are limited in terms of norepinephrine versus terlipressin, but I think looking at meta-analyses, retrospective studies, norepinephrine is probably less potent, probably, and has also fewer side effects. On the other hand, I have to say that if I put on my research hat, it's very difficult to conduct high-quality studies in these kinds of populations. They're very sick. Norepinephrine is used often as a vasopressor in the ICU for multi-organ failure. So I don't know that I've seen good apples-to-apples comparisons.
That makes a lot of sense. These studies are probably really hard to operationalize and compare. Finally, let's talk about our last vasoconstrictor, midodrine octreotide.
So midodrine, selective alpha-1 agonist, and then octreotide inhibits the release of glucagon and helps also with the splanchnic vasodilation. And actually, after I've dug into the literature, we really, especially now, I think we use it to make ourselves feel better. And it does increase your MAP. So you can increase your MAP with midodrine, but it's just not as potent of a vasoconstrictor cocktail. And definitely enough studies have been done with terlipressin versus MAO, midodrine octreotide albumin, and terlipressin is much more potent.
So it sounds like we should try to reach for terlipressin in terms of potency, at least with the evidence that we have. But say our patient might have a contraindication to terlipressin, we could reach for the midodrine octreotide combo.
A more controversial point would be if you're hedging and not entirely sure about the diagnosis of HRS, it's probably safer to start with midodrine octreotide since it has less side effects.
That's fair. That's fair and important point. Okay, so let's summarize Pearl 1 on vasoconstrictive treatment for hepatorenal syndrome. The goal here is to raise that MAP by 10 to 15 millimeters per mercury. And Noah, why don't you summarize the different vasoconstrictors, maybe in reverse order to cement it a different way?
Thanks, Shreya. So midodrine octreotide is the least effective, but has the least side effects. So if you aren't entirely sure if it's HRS, you can start here. If you're seeing a rise in the MAP with midodrine octreotide alone, you should continue it. But if you're worried that it's not working, then you have to think about escalating.
And if you're in the position of escalating, that might be terlipressin or norepinephrine, depending on where your patient physically is. And then some nuances about terlipressin. It was really the confirmed trial that put terlipressin on the map, to borrow your pun, with more reversal of hepatorenal syndrome and less need for dialysis compared to albumin. The contraindications, though, to terlipressin to be aware of is if the creatinine is over 5, if they have acute liver failure, grade 3, signs of overload that would risk respiratory compromise, or any signs of active ischemia. Okay, I think I have a good handle on the three different vasoconstrictors that we have. What about albumin in hepatorenal syndrome? I think sometimes I see albumin given with one of these three vasoconstrictors. Sometimes we don't.
I only give albumin to achieve euvolemia day 1 or 2 or however many days you think. And that if there's some other reason to use albumin, I will, like they're getting paracentesis or we think they have SPP. Normally kind of go with that normal protocol, unless there's some contraindication as far as the respiratory or volume status, but otherwise I don't. And in fact, if you look at confirmed trial, that was one of the big criticisms was that they kept giving patients albumin over and over again, and that may have contributed to some of the respiratory failure outcomes as well.
In the confirmed trial, 14% of patients in the terlipressin plus albumin group had respiratory failure versus 5% in the albumin only group.
That is wild to think about in terms of the amount of respiratory failure with a combo terlipressin plus albumin.
Yeah, and what's even more wild is 17 patients in the terlipressin group died of respiratory failure versus only 1 in the albumin alone group.
Wow.
I think what really came up in a lot of journal clubs after this trial was it just the terlipressin that was the problem? Or was it that they were continuing to give albumin with the terlipressin and that was what really pushed patients over the edge in terms of their volume status?
Yeah. Looking at the protocol, right, it's like a kind of a loose requirement. They could give albumin on day 1, 1 gram per keg to a maximum of 100 grams, and then 20 to 40 grams a day thereafter, and not kind of defining an endpoint.
I think it's really important to say that technically all the trials and guidelines would recommend vasoconstrictor plus albumin, but the conversation is becoming a lot more nuanced. We saw that using terlipressin plus albumin literally killed people through respiratory distress. So we need to be careful and not just blindly give every patient albumin.
Yeah, I appreciate that a lot. And it sounds like different people will have different practices, but for Dr. Mazumdar, his practice is to not always give albumin and really only give it to get that patient to euvolemia. And then in terms of how much albumin to reach euvolemia, again, different practice patterns, but for some, it's 1 gram per kg per day up to that 100 grams a day. All right, Noah, why don't you summarize what you want people to take away when it comes to giving albumin in HRS?
It's a small but really important takeaway. In HRS, we should really just give albumin to get our patients to euvolemia and then stop.
All right, now with all that albumin talk, I think we're ready for the next level, which is volume management. And gosh, this is, you know, the stuff that we are humming and hawing about on rounds. And the stakes are high. And at the same time, the answer isn't always clear cut. And I really appreciate having a space to pick the discussant's brain about what their practices are and some of their rules of thumb.
We just talked about the risk of respiratory compromise. So the first thing I really wanted to hear from our discussants was if and how they give Lasix for HRS patients that are grossly volume overloaded.
Many of these patients arrive hypervolemic. If you give them diuretics before the vasoconstrictor, sometimes diuretics just don't work. Why? Because, you know, remember that no BP, no PP, right? If you don't have good hemodynamics, your diuretics are not going to kick in. So once you restore the hemodynamics, not only you're treating HRS, you are going to enable successful diuresis. But of course, there was this concern, wait a second, you give diuretics, you're going to throw the patient back into HRS. So what we decided to do is to look at those patients. What was the observation? We have about 20 plus patients in this cohort, very small cohort, of course, but it was a very specific observation that we were targeting. And first of all, addition of intravenous furosemide, high doses like 160 Q12, something like that, to norepinephrine led to a substantial rise in urine output from somewhere in between 800 mL a day all the way to over 2 liters a day. So it worked in terms of a diuretic effect, fine. The next step is what happened with the trajectory of the creatinine? Well, the trajectory of creatinine remained unchanged. In other words, whatever was happening with the creatinine prior to the diuretic continue to happen with the diuretic. So we're not claiming that diuretics improve kidney function, help the recovery, nothing of that nature. But what we observe is that the diuretics did not have a negative impact in the course of AKI. So it doesn't put you back into HRS. That's kind of the observation. So I think we have to move a little bit away from this albumin approach. And then we start thinking to a more balanced where, yes, some patients should be treated with albumin aggressively. Some patients don't need any of the albumin, nothing at all. And some patients may actually need to be diuresed.
Okay, wow. So much to unpack there. I really appreciate hearing all the nuance. And I think, you know, if I step back, when it comes to hepatorenal syndrome, we need to really understand the patient in front of us and figure out two big questions. One, what are we giving in terms of raising that MAP up to, you know, 10 to 15 milligrams per mercury? And then is albumin right or is diuresis right or neither?
Classic fodder to come up every time on rounds, Shreya. Mm-hmm. And I just felt really relieved to know that once you have successfully raised that MAP, there is evidence it's safe to give diuretics if the patient needs it.
Yeah. And it was also helpful to hear that if you give diuretics too early, it's not like it'll cause harm, but that kidney just won't have that blood pressure to successfully make urine. And so try and get that blood pressure up first, or as the cool kids or the nephrologists say, get the BP up before you can get some PP.
I'm glad somebody thanks the nephrologists or the cool kids.
Yeah, they're awesome.
I think the most common hesitancy, which is real, is the creatinine number. But it's not as important as the patient's status. And so the physical exam and volume exam, I think, is one of the most important things that distinguishes an internal medicine doctor from other physicians and medical providers. And I think that treating patients, as you alluded to, based on diuresing them if they're volume overloaded or providing fluids that they're not sure otherwise, I think is one of the most counterintuitive parts when the creatinine is rising. And I wouldn't jump to diuresis unless the patient really needed it, but I wouldn't hold it if the patient did need it because the creatinine was elevated. And so we see this often in the outpatient regimen area where you start them on some diuretics and their creatinine goes up by like 0.2 or 0.3 or something, but their ascites is totally uncontrolled. They're not with firing paracentesis. But if you're crimping down the kidneys a bit and the creatinine's going up and it's benefiting the patient from a clinical perspective, I think that's the one of the biggest things I've learned in fellowship and going into being an attendant is like that 0.2, 0.3 of creatinine might be worth it if it's providing some clinical benefits to the patient. And so it may not be worth it if they're still getting paracentesis every week and they're not really changing anything. But in those patients, you can kind of move the needle on the quality of life or their bad things that are happening to them. I think that's one of the most common areas in which I help is I am comfortable just saying, no, we're just going to keep on diuretics.
So this is also giving me flashbacks to our cardiorenal syndrome, where we're really kind of sitting with the idea it's okay to have some permissive hypercreatinemia if the patient is clinically improving. Noah, do you want to take a stab at trying to recap the hard and nuanced volume management of hepatorenal syndrome, which, to be fair, is way more nuanced and very case by case?
I will take a stab at it and try my best, Shreya. The first thing to do is raise the MAP. You aren't going to get good diuresis without blood pressure. Once you've successfully raised the MAP, we do have some data to say that we will not put the kidneys back into HRS with diuresis. We might have to be okay with some permissive hypercreatinemia and prioritize clinical volume status if the patient needs it. But as we've been saying, this is really hard and nuanced, and all we can do is do our best with what we think the patient's volume status is.
The holidays are sneaking up fast, and I am obsessed with uncommon goods. As the name suggests, it's thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts that you can't find anywhere else. And I can't stop scrolling through Uncommon Goods, and hence I'm recording this late. Because honestly, most of the time, I feel stuck with what to get my niece or my nephews. It already feels like they have so much. And what can I possibly get them? But the things at Uncommon Goods are so different. It's high-quality, unique products, often handmade, made in the U.S. And there's something for everyone, right? Moms, dads, teens, the diehard football fans, to foodies, aka all my cousins, even I can get gardening stuff for my dad. There's thousands of new gift ideas you won't find anywhere else. And when you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Many of their handcrafted products are actually made in small batches. So, you know, of course, shop now before they sell out this holiday season. And with every purchase you make Uncommon Goods, they actually give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So shop early this holiday season and have fun. Cross some names off that list today. Get 15% off your next gift. Go to uncommongoods.com/coreIAM. That's uncommongoods.com/coreIAM for 15% off. Don't miss out on this time-limited offer, Uncommon Goods. As they say, we're all out of the ordinary. And with that, let's get back to the episode. Here at Coreum, we're talking about the real things that can help anyone who works in healthcare. And today we are talking about how the scrubs you wear, they can make a difference. I remember the first time I saw one of my colleagues walking into a sign-in room looking way more put together after a night shift, and I knew right then and there they were wearing FIGS. FIGS scrubs are made specifically for doctors, residents, students, and healthcare professionals like us. We're putting in long hours, and we need gear that can keep up and perform at our level. You have so much going on during any shift, and your scrubs is the last thing you want to think about. And that's why FIGS are lightweight, stretchy, and breathable. Plus, they have all those small touches that really have made me a true convert. The fit is clean, modern, super functional, tons of pockets, which I love for all the snacks, zippers that don't snag, and antimicrobial fabric to stay healthy while working in the clinic or in the hospital. You deserve better scrubs. You deserve FIGS. So head over to wearfigs.com and enter FIGSRX at the checkout for 15% off your first purchase. That's wearfigs.com, promo code FIGSRX for 15% off your first order. And with that, let's get back to the episode.
So we talked all about treatment. Now let's get into when we're giving this treatment, what if things aren't going well? I think this brings up the most important point and why people, when they see hepatorenal syndrome in their one-liner, kind of get, ugh, is that it has such a high mortality rate. Why is that mortality rate in hepatorenal syndrome so high?
Why is mortality so high in HRS? That was a great, I actually really love that question. So because we have the portal hypertension physiology, so we know we have a very hard liver for the most part. We have portal hypertension, and that comes with all of this bacterial translocation predisposition to infections. And so that's one part of it, is that your liver portal hypertension plus synthetic dysfunction. Plus the other thing is what triggers HRS is like the company it keeps, so to speak. So sepsis, organ failure, severe bleeding. So that's why the mortality is high.
All right, let's continue with the dark side of things. And what if the vasoconstrictors that we chose aren't working? We try other things, not working.
So we tried to prevent renal failure in HRS, but the creatinine's still rising, potassium's up to 6 despite potassium binders, the patient's not peed in 2 days. The next question to ask yourself is this patient a liver transplant candidate? The reason we have to ask ourselves that is because we have reached AEIOU indications for dialysis. And now we have to think to ourselves, can we use dialysis as a bridge to liver transplant?
Okay. So I guess that makes sense. And to connect it back to episode 1, you know, we learned that most patients in hepatorenal syndrome, their kidneys are actually fine. So dialysis here is just temporary, right? Once that patient gets a liver and has return of good blood flow to their kidney, the kidney will get back up and just do its thing like the olden days.
The question is, how do we know who gets the liver, though? I think the ethics of liver transplant have always fascinated me, but that's probably a whole other episode for itself. So for us to remember right now, it is the MELD score that determines a liver transplant priority.
So the new MELD score is the MELD 3.0, which is your total bilirubin, your INR, your creatinine, sodium, and now albumin and also sex, because women were disadvantaged. Because women have lower muscle mass, they have lower creatinine for GFR, and there were some other issues. So that's the MELD 3.0. So creatinine has a pretty hefty weight in the MELD 3.0. And the MELD score, to remind everyone, prioritizes people on the liver for the liver transplant wait list based on likelihood of mortality. So it's urgency-based prioritization. So the worse your AKI, the higher your creatinine, the higher your liver transplant priority. And that's because your mortality is high. But there's a paradox here that if we get your kidney function better, your MELD score will improve. And then you were very ill at one point, but you've lost your MELD points, right? So this is a little bit nuanced, but in the United States, if your MELD score is above 25, you have to update that MELD score every 7 days. So if you imagine someone comes in with an AKI, creatinine of 3, and then they're on terlipressin, and then they improve, and a week later, their creatinine is 1.5, their MELD score went down and their priority is lower. Is it possible that some people withhold terlipressin in this setting potentially when the MELD is really high? Because you know that the most durable treatment for this patient is actually transplant.
Just as I was saying, the ethics of transplant are a thing in its own. It gets complicated so fast.
Yeah, and it makes me think, if the creatinine is part of the MELD score, say our patient gets dialysis as a temporary bridge, won't that then change the creatinine and then affect our patient's transplant candidate priority?
So if you're on dialysis, it's as if your creatinine is 3. It's the same thing. So you get the biggest benefit for kidney injury if you're on dialysis. And even if you have extremely low muscle mass and your creatinine is only 1.5 or 2, you're still going to get the maximum points if you're on dialysis.
Okay, so dialysis will give our patient the most amount of points when it comes to creatinine, so we're okay there.
I just think transplants are so cool, and what's even cooler is we have the ability to replace 2 organs at the same time.
2 organs? You mean the liver and the kidney? Noah, why would we need the kidney? We just spent a bunch of time talking about how the kidneys are fine in hepatorenal syndrome.
Most of the time they are, but the longer HRS goes on, the more likely it is that the kidneys won't recover. It's also important to think about patients who started off with some baseline chronic kidney disease. Those scarred kidneys probably won't recover. You can refer to our show notes for the full criteria of when to do a simultaneous kidney liver transplant.
Yeah, interesting. What if our patient, you know, gets called that they have a liver available to them and they go through the liver transplant and the kidney doesn't recover as we expect it to?
So what's really nice is for patients that aren't initially simultaneous liver-kidney transplants, there's something called the safety net. The safety net moves the patient who only got a liver to the top of the kidney transplant list if their kidney doesn't wake up after the liver transplant surgery.
Oh, man, I'm glad they have these in place. I think there's so much nuances to go into, but I guess why don't we pause and recap some of the more salient points. And I think for me, what I'm understanding now is that liver transplant, we base it off the MELD, which is very heavily dependent on how the kidney is doing.
And I think the big learning for me was that dialysis is just a bridge to liver transplant. And the criteria for that is the same for any new dialysis, right? The AEIOU criteria. And because with most liver transplants, we expect the kidneys to recover just fine. We don't jump to a simultaneous liver-kidney transplant and prioritize the liver transplant first. All right, now let's get into the real dark side of things. Say our patient is not a liver transplant candidate. Say, for example, they have some type of active cancer that is outside the liver. Or I think the real sad situation is that if this patient doesn't have the social support they need to come to appointments or get labs with the immunosuppressants they would be on after a transplant.
That's when we have to think about goals of care discussions. If the patient is not on a liver transplant list and they have rapidly progressive renal injury that requires dialysis with no ability to reverse the underlying liver physiology, this is where I strongly believe we should involve palliative care because we don't really have dialysis as a bridge to an improvement.
What an impossible situation. Do we pursue dialysis for this patient knowing that there aren't any options to fix the liver and they're going to die even with dialysis?
Yeah, it just seems like dialysis here is such a temporary band-aid, right? I mean, for how long and to what quality of life are we bridging to?
And I do try to be frank, very frank from a liver standpoint and explain that this is what's going on with your liver. This is how we would treat the liver problem and transplant normally, you know, could be a way that we would treat this. But however, in this scenario, we cannot do liver transplant for XYZ reason. And then I explained, so in the case of, let's say, HRSAKI and other sepsis decompensations and the need for dialysis, let's say, I explained that putting them on dialysis will generally not improve the sepsis, will not resolve the liver dysfunction. And so that's not something that will help them get to back to where they were. So I think it's better to try to get on the same page, honestly outline expectations, and explain what medically is feasible versus not. And I know that some people like the best case scenario, worst case scenario rubric, right? Best case scenario, your infection gets treated and you get a liver transplant. That works if somebody could be a transplant candidate. And worst case, you know, the liver gets worse and transplant's not on the table. That's useful. But some people don't necessarily have a scenario where the best case is returning them to prior function. So best case could be being symptom-free, being with family. So you really have to be honest and upfront. It's not always a menu of good options.
So if the patient is able to tolerate a session in the hospital and you can prepare for a clinic, then you're going to have to explain, okay, so the expectation is that we don't do dialysis, your survival may be days, just as an example. But if we do dialysis, your survival will be 3 months, 6 months. It's not that we're going to gain a 2 year, unlikely, right? So you present that to the patient. And sometimes that is a meaningful extension of their lives because they need to go home, they need to get their family together, and they need to process that, right?
So heavy to hear, but also helpful, right? Helpful to know that without a liver transplant and hepatorenal syndrome, dialysis might only buy someone a few months, 3 to 5 months or so.
For me, I really loved that best case, worst case framework. Sometimes patients need to know that their best case, even with dialysis, may not involve being independent enough to, say, take a walk in the park. Even with dialysis, some patients' best case may be just getting medicine to control symptoms while they're with family as long as possible until they peacefully pass away.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it gets even trickier when patients can't tolerate that dialysis.
One of the tricky parts about offering everybody dialysis is that if they're very hypotensive because they're kind of an end-stage portal hypertensive patient, often they won't tolerate dialysis. You know, for example, they'll put the catheter in, you're attached into the machine, and the blood pressure will be too low for them to actually get dialysis. So on paper, they're on dialysis, but physiologically or biochemically, they're not really getting cleaned by the machine or getting volume removed.
You know, when he said that, I was like, wow, why didn't I think of that earlier, that these patients might not be able to tolerate dialysis, right? You know, we probably urgently like put in a dialysis catheter, hoping dialysis would help, got them connected to these machines. And lo and behold, after all that, they weren't able to tolerate it.
I agree, Shreya. It is a very humbling thought. So to recap, if liver transplant is not in the cards, unfortunately, the options are a few months of dialysis or just comfort care for a week or two if dialysis is not within their goals of cares. I'm really sorry to end this podcast on such a depressing note, but I think really good palliative care is extremely rewarding in itself, and it's really important to take ownership of this aspect of hepatorenal disease, but also take ownership of our patients and helping them transition to their death.
Yeah. I think hepatorenal syndrome is not for the faint of heart. It is such a tough disease process that mortality is so high. And I think we did right, Noah, by spending this much time on the dark side. And hopefully this will help our patients sit through it if they should come to that crossroads.
And that is a wrap for today.
If you found this episode helpful, our ask is that you share it with your team, your colleagues, share it with someone else, because hepatorenal syndrome can be tough.
Thank you to our reviewers, Dr. Tapper and Dr. Belcher. As always, opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliative institutions. Thank you and take care.